Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, Tanzania is expanding its involvement in the tobacco industry by growing and processing it. But is the government promoting an industry that is damaging to the health of its citizens? And we catch up with a young man who took Ghana's education ministry to court when it refused him entry into a very prestigious school. Tyrone Margai explains exactly why he did it.
If every Rastafarian kid that's coming to school has to cut their hair, then it doesn't feel right. We had to go to the human rights court.
Would you have cut your locks to go to Achimota? Because, I mean, it's really, truly a prestigious school.
Okay, the simple answer is no. Because I knew that it was going to affect an entire community if I choose to cut my hair.
It's Tuesday, the 17th of September. First, we go to Kenya. President William Ruto and the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz recently signed a labour deal in which Kenya will send skilled and semi-skilled workers to Germany. The European country needs labour. Kenya has a very young and energetic labour force. Sounds like a no-brainer. But the deal is controversial for different reasons in the two countries. President Ruto said 250,000 Kenyans would be allowed to work in Germany. The Germans say no numbers have yet been agreed.
I think this framework gives us an opportunity to avoid illegal migrants, because illegal migrants pose a problem both to us and to Germany.
Kenyans have received the news of possible job opportunities in Germany with mixed emotions. This is Mukami. She lays bare her conflicts about the deal.
Would I want? No. Do I need to? Yes. There is a safety net that comes from being home. Just safety of knowing your home and no racism and all that, because those are issues that come up when working abroad. So if I would have work here, then I would want to work here. But right now, the current situation in the country, there are no jobs for young people. So many young people are jobless. It's a necessary evil that people go out there, you know, and look for better avenues to empower themselves, especially financially. And despite this being a necessary evil, I do acknowledge the efforts by the government to, you know, salvage the situation by looking for help outside. I myself have applied for a job in Germany. I did my first interview. It's a hotel job. And I'm awaiting my second interview. Some of the pointers I actually learned also from all of these applications and opportunities is that, you know, the need to also learn the German language. I really hope many young people are going to embrace these efforts by the government. It's important to also think about our future.
Germany has its own issues to deal with concerning foreign workers coming into the country, even though it doesn't have enough people from Germany to fill the numbers of jobs it has available. Christoph Kannengießer is the CEO of the German African Business Association in Berlin. We've been talking about the political and economic issues highlighted by this deal with Kenya. Let's talk about this deal between Germany and Kenya. It's become somewhat controversial because the numbers that are being claimed by Kenya. So from your end, can you tell us the broad strokes of the deal that you are aware of?
So first of all, there are no numbers in the deal. There are no quotas. How many Kenyans respond to the invitation of German companies and the German government to come to Germany to work here and to get qualified here is up to the interest of young Kenyans.
So why were there no figures?
Because we don't need figures. The challenge is to get enough young people from all over the world to fill the gaps on our labor market. We need about 400,000 workers each year from abroad to keep our labor market working. So we have to motivate young people to come and not define limits.
What kind of jobs will people be doing?
All kind of jobs. We have labor shortages in almost all sectors here in Germany. We discuss a lot about the healthcare sector, and this is a very relevant one. But it is also about engineers, about handicraft, about people in the IT sector. So a lot of qualifications are needed. And so for a lot of young Kenyans with different qualifications, there are options and opportunities in the German labor market if they want to come.
And what kind of things will people need, and how would you make it possible for them to want to come to Germany?
Yeah, so first of all, they have to get language skills because it helps very much in the labor market and also to integrate in our society. You don't need a high level of language skill from the first day on, but working on that is an important step. And that's why we ask the German government to provide an infrastructure to learn, a better infrastructure to learn German. The other thing is an appropriate and matching qualification for needs in the labor market. But there is also the opportunity and the possibility to add qualifications here in Germany, but also locally in Kenya itself, as German companies are very much interested to recruit young Kenyans. They are also ready to provide the needed structures to support them learning what they need to fulfill the needs on their jobs.
And how hospitable are you going to make it? Because we've all been reading about far-right parties gaining ground in Europe. And in fact, in Germany, one of those parties has just won regional elections. We see people being treated very badly. How are you going to prepare people for racism in Europe? Because these are Kenyans.
Yeah, yeah.
Where they come from, they're not subject to this kind of behavior.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that. And it is something which is also in our mind as German companies and German private sectors. And we are very much lobbying here in Germany for what we call a welcoming culture, to be open-minded to people coming from abroad. And we fight racism and xenophobia here in our country. And I would like to convince you that the vast majority of Germans are very friendly and open also to people coming from Kenya. But there is a radical minority, and this is an issue of concern here in our country. And we have to do everything what is necessary to also protect people coming from abroad and living here in Germany against these kinds of activities.
A minority is all it takes, right? So what I'm wondering is, because Germany was very welcoming, for instance, of Syrians not so long ago, and also Ukrainians. But we're talking about Africans who look different to the Syrians. They look different to the Ukrainians. So what kinds of things would you be looking at? Because the Turks, for instance, have been complaining about racism for the longest time. They've been in Germany for very, very long as migrant workers and, you know, foreign labor.
I have people in my staff coming from Africa, so I know these stories from very close. And of course, we are concerned about that. And we are doing what we can to change the mindset. But if you have radical parties, they are playing with these resentments in some parts of the population, and they are trying to radicalize the society. And
with some success, though, isn't it?
With some success.
So is there a government policy and business policy to try and reverse it, at least in the workplace, and to make people aware of their rights, for instance?
The workplace is the best place to overcome any kind of prejudices and clichés. And the workplace is where integration takes place. And the workplace is where people learn that people coming from elsewhere are the same as they are. So my personal opinion is the more we have young people being integrated in our labor market, the less radical political parties have success by stimulating xenophobia and racism. We as companies and private sector, we do everything to overcome this climate in our society, which is a big concern for all of us.
Which other countries will people be coming from? Which other countries have been invited to send workers to Germany?
We send an invitation to all over the world, but we are, of course, also trying to specifically cooperate with countries in Africa, for instance, with Morocco, with Ghana, with Kenya, with Nigeria, but also in Eastern Europe with, for instance, Uzbekistan. Of course, also in Asia, in countries such as India, Indonesia and Malaysia, for instance, Vietnam, and also from Latin America. But Africa, of course, is our neighboring continent compared to our very favorable demography. So I think it makes sense to strengthen our cooperation with African countries and to add to the migration agreement with Kenya, others with other African countries.
Now, we can see what Germany would get out of this agreement. You'd get goods and services, your economy will be stimulated. What are the social and political implications, you think, of migration to both sender and recipient countries?
First of all, when it comes to the sending countries, it takes some pressure from the labor market and it opens perspectives for young people. I think this is politically important. This is also an incentive to invest into qualification for young people because they have more opportunities than the currently relatively limited one on the domestic labor market. I'm also convinced that we will see not only migration to Europe and Germany, but that we will see also more and more remote work within the country. So German companies working with young Kenyans, young Tanzanians, young Nigerians in Nigeria in a way we have already experienced with India, for instance. Those who come here can also serve as kind of a cultural and economic bridge between Germany and Europe and the African continent.
Thank you very much. That's been really interesting.
Yeah, interesting for me as well. And I hope it was useful.
Very useful. That's Christoph Kannengießer, CEO of the German African Business Association in Berlin. We're popping over to Tanzania for our next story. And again, it involves governments doing what governments think they need to do to grow their economies and employ their citizens. In this case, President Samia Suluhu Hassan recently broke ground on a new $300 million cigarette factory in Serengeti. It's part of a broader push to grow the tobacco processing industry in Tanzania. The country's been expanding the number of tobacco factories at an astonishing rate since 2021, bringing in potential revenue of up to $700 million a year. Sounds good, doesn't it? Depends on where you stand on smoking tobacco, though. Governments around the world are actively trying to limit the numbers of smokers because of the health burden it creates on national health systems. Tanzania is one of those governments. Nearly 22,000 of its citizens die of tobacco-related illnesses every year. And tobacco companies are accused of directing their most aggressive marketing tactics at young people in Africa. So why is the Tanzanian government going against the direction of travel on this by seeming to promote the growth of an industry that is deemed harmful by health experts? Timothy Mbage is executive director of the Agricultural Council of Tanzania, an umbrella private sector organization lobbying for policies and business environment issues affecting the agricultural sector. So how does he feel about these moves by the government in the last few years?
He just inherited the policies because, you know, Tanzania was traditionally growing the tobacco, the source of income for smallholder farmers, especially in the Western Zone, in Tabora regions particularly. So there was no option for her to do anything rather than supporting the industries because there's no any other alternative for those farmers. Though she wishes, if possible, she could have got some kind of like international community supporting to give the alternative crop and subsidies to the farmer so that they can do away with the tobacco. And if you follow recently, she has inaugurated a new tobacco processing company in Morogoro. And she was like saying that she thinks it's better even those people from those investors can also support the health of the people. So in the other way, she's still very sympathetic to the health of the people, but economically, alternative is limited.
But you can't have it both ways, though, can you? Encouraging a tobacco industry, which is quite damaging. More than 20,000 Tanzanians die from tobacco-related illnesses. And then on the other hand, saying you want to encourage the health of people. What are the options?
For me, what I'm thinking is it is just international community which has just like leaving aside the farmers, not supporting them, because those farmers really, they wish, even myself, I've been working in that areas. I was a trainer and researchers in that areas. What I came to find that it's very difficult. The crop is difficult to rise and it's tedious, it's troublesome, it's disturbing.
What you mean? You mean tobacco, to grow tobacco?
Yes, tobacco, yes. But the farmers, they don't have any alternative crops to generate their cash.
I mean, lots of countries used to grow tobacco, but
yes,
they stopped because of a decline in tobacco smoking around the world. But tobacco smoking is encouraged quite aggressively by African countries. Surely Tanzania can forge its own direction and its own policies and encourage the growth of food crops or even flowers, for instance. It's not forced to grow tobacco, is it?
They are growing foods. Remember that we are talking about the cash crop here. It's not the food crop. Even the people in that area, they are not buying food. They are producing their own food. But we are talking about the cash crop. But the issue is there's no any support, serious support from the international community.
But I think that's like the center of my argument. That's the center of my argument.
Yes.
Do you need the international community to do this?
Exactly.
Or should
even
Tanzania...
Even myself, I have participated in different forum organized by World Health Organization. And our farmer, we are ready even from yesterday to leave or to do away with the tobacco. If at all they will get assistance for alternative crops, they'll need some subsidies while they acclimatize the new crops. For example, the Tabora is a very good place for the cashew nuts. They can grow cashew nuts, but it can take 5 years to 10 years from the day of planting to the day of harvesting. So how are they going to survive in these 10 years? So they will need some kind of subsidy, some kind of alternative. That is what their farmer are crying for.
Must it come from the international community in the form of subsidies, or can Tanzania actually forge its own path and say, well, we are going to find a way of transitioning from this crop to different crops in order to preserve the health of our people and to be more beneficial in general to the economy?
Yes. I think the issue here is about the economic capacity of the country. Our countries, especially African countries, are very poor. They are always, all the times, they are getting loans from outside for other development. So they don't have that capacity of any capability, economic capability of giving the subsidies to the farmers. That's why they have no choice. But otherwise, if our government could be a rich government like European country government, of which it subsidizes even the farmers, they could have done so for some years.
I'm wondering how much influence the tobacco industry is actually exerting on an economy like Tanzania, taking advantage of the fact that Tanzania considers itself to be a poor country, and also that its markets, its growing markets, are in third world countries like Tanzania. So I'm not accusing you of making propaganda for the tobacco companies, but I am wondering whether tobacco companies are not lobbying governments in order to build their business rather than look to the concerns of the economy of a country like Tanzania and the health of the people of Tanzania.
To me, I think the way forward is to see on looking the way with the current technology and how we can help our people. Because not only the health, but also it is in the expenses of environment. Because growing the tobacco, it cut a lot of trees. A lot of forests are put down every single year. So we are losing a lot of forest. We are contributing to the challenge of the climate change. So I think the way forward is also to look into how we can use the current technology and today the world technology has to make sure that we are not destroying the environment anymore. For instance, we can use technology of drying the tobacco by using the sunlight rather than cutting down the trees using the fuel wood. So those are the kind of the things that we probably have to think on how we can go, even to put pressures, regulatory pressures, to those tobacco company to promote those kind of the methodology of drying tobacco. Those are the issues we can do today. And when we are ready now to subsidize the farmers, getting them out of the tobacco, then we can have the other crop.
You mentioned cashew nut as an alternative crop to tobacco. What else? What other crops?
Yeah, I think the cashew nut, because it's a kind of the like permanent kind of crop, but also because I've been working in that area, it is also... The sunflower is really wonderful in that area. They can also have that kind of crop as well.
What about coffee? I spoke to somebody recently in Kenya, and you were saying
in that area.
In that area, would you be able to grow coffee?
No, we cannot. We cannot do coffee in that area. You can do, it's like, coffee is a kind of like, it needs a low temperature, a kind of crop. It goes in the higher altitude. like in Kilimanjaro, in Bukoba, in southern highland of Tanzania.
Now, President Hassan indicated that tobacco producers could contribute to Tanzania's universal healthcare scheme, I suppose in compensation for the fact that so many Tanzanians are dying from tobacco smoking and that tobacco companies are aggressively marketing their products in places like Tanzania. Do you think that will happen and it should happen?
By the way, you know, it's very strange enough. Tanzania is the second producer of tobacco in Africa behind Zimbabwe. But the company which are producing cigarettes in Tanzania is only 5% which is sold within the Tanzanian market.
But many of them are dying, and tobacco companies actually rely on local markets and in third world countries to grow their markets, because in first world countries, people are smoking less. So it's a general point, not necessarily specific to Tanzania. But my question was, do you think that it should happen that tobacco growers and tobacco producers should contribute to the healthcare bill in Tanzania, as the president suggested?
Yeah, of course, it has to be so, not only for the healthcare, but also for the environment. That's why we are saying that maybe the government should put some pressures and regulatory pressures which will force them to buy the tobacco which has been dried by using sand rather than buying the tobacco which has been dried by using the fuel wood. Because it has also health hazard. If you are drying tobacco using the fuel wood, it's very terrible kind of business, health-wise. You know, lot of smokes inside and a lot of things.
Are the tobacco companies actually lobbying the government to keep producing tobacco in the country and also to build tobacco processing companies and factories in Tanzania? Is there a lobbying going on?
No, I'm not sure of that things because, for example, there was a lot of crying from the tobacco companies that they haven't even been paid back the VAT returns. So there was a lot of issues. Even as I'm talking today, there was some tobacco company which even left the countries because of that kind of, like, they are seeing that the government is not supporting their presence. So it's not that they are lobbying for the government, but it's just because of economic pressure that the government cannot help the tobacco farmers.
Timothy Mbage, Executive Director of the Agricultural Council of Tanzania. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Rising temperatures,
the extreme weather,
melting ice,
they're all interconnected.
How can we solve this?
The Climate Question is the podcast exploring why we find it so hard to save our own planet.
We have many of the tools that we need.
And how we might change that.
If we do smart things right now, we can take care of our descendants.
It is a question of awareness, it is a question of information and access to that information.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service.
It is based on experience and it is based on science.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now let's talk about hair and hairstyles and judgments about hair and hairstyles. Locks, or dreadlocks as it is more commonly known, is a sign of allegiance to the Rastafarian religion. It can also just be a lifestyle choice, unaffiliated to the practice of Rastafarianism. Either way, those who wear their hair that way are often judged, accused of being drug takers or drug dealers, and discriminated against for acting outside of the norms of these societies. A case came up in Ghana a few years ago involving a boy who was denied admission to a prestigious school. Tyrone Margai was the child of a Rastafarian musician, and he and his sisters followed that religion too. So he had locks in keeping with the dictates of the faith. When he was denied the right to keep his locks, he took the Ghanaian Department of Education to court at the Human Rights Division of the Accra High Court. The intention was to enforce his right to an education. He won, and now he is studying in the United States after attaining perfect scores in the West African Senior School Certification Examination, WASI for short. And those who know about WASI know what it means for him to have attained those perfect scores. He is studying computer engineering at the University of Pennsylvania in the US, and we had a delightful conversation about his early life as one of triplets, he has two sisters, and the good fortune his intellectual brilliance has brought.
Tyrone Magai. You're welcome to Focus on Africa. And congratulations. You are going to go to university with no financial worries at all.
Not at all. Sometimes I sit back and wonder, like, my background and where I am currently, and it's just overwhelming.
Tell us about your background. What kind of a family do you come from?
I'm triplets. I have a first sister, I'm second, and then a last sister. And we were born in Kumasi, originally in Ghana. My background is kind of a bit different from others because we had to stay on a bus for like 3 years in Ghana. And that was partly because my dad is a musician. So he formed a band with all three of us as musicians. And that was when we were about 11, 12, thereabout. But for my background, we're Rastafarians with dreadlocks. So I think after the high school, I got into Achimota school because I passed the exams. And that is when a lot of the other stuff happened. With the other stuff, I mean getting into Achimota school and being asked to cut my hair before I get into the school.
Yeah, and Achimota, I mean, to get into Achimota, you go down in history when you do. You join a long line of illustrious Ghanaians who've gone to Achimota. And I'm not even going to mention the other schools that are in competition for that particular title because I don't want to get into trouble with all the Ghanaians I know.
All the Ghanaians, that's true.
But they wouldn't let you go to the school because the school is so upright. It's got this massive reputation and all of that. And dreadlocks, they felt, was what?
They felt that there was a general conformity that everyone had to obey. And that is whether you're a boy or you're a girl, once you're in Achimota school, you need to keep a very low haircut. And so it meant that my locks were going down. And also, they felt that my locks would interfere with my academics in the sense that locks generally need maintenance. So you just cut it for like the 3 years that you'll be at the school.
But you dismissed the arguments or did you agree with them? And also tell us, having the locks, was it part of lifestyle, a choice, or religion?
It was part of culture and religion. I almost agreed with them, but not to a certain extent. First of all, it wasn't just me. If it was maybe only I was the only unique instance, then all the decisions would have depended on me. But I felt like it was an entire community. And so if every Rastafarian kid that's coming to school has to cut their hair, then it doesn't feel right. We had to go to the human rights court. So over there, we're arguing of my competence to be in there at the school and that I qualified to be there. And also the fact that the students cannot be denied enrollment just because of their hair or their religious background.
And you won, did you?
yes, I did. It was like the first case. Yeah, I think the first case of its kind, at least to my knowledge, in the human rights court.
Well, I mean, you were the first person ever to have locks at Achimota, the esteemed Achimota. Would you have cut your locks to go to Achimota? Because, I mean, it's really, truly a prestigious school.
Okay, the simple answer is no. No, because I understood that it wasn't about me. I feel like if it was only about me, maybe it's something that peculiar to only me and that I could choose to change and have it later, then it could be worth it. But I knew that it was going to affect an entire community if I chose to cut my hair.
So did the other students and the teachers sort of have issues with you having taken the school to court, winning, and then being the student with the locks when everybody else has got low-cut hair?
I later got to understand that it was not really the school that I was in court with. It's more like the school is under the general education system of Ghana. And so when I got into the school, the teachers and the students, it was as if nothing ever happened because the teachers were all welcoming. The students were all equally welcoming. I think Achimota, the experience there was amazing.
Okay, so I know that in Ghana, and I would say up to about 10 years ago, people looked at you funny if you had locks, because I've had that experience. What are people's perceptions of people with locks? How do they regard it?
for me, my main experience is perhaps with Achimota School, and almost that's all. But I hear stories of older Rastafarians with locks, and they talk about the extreme sense of discrimination in Ghana, because I don't drive, but they talk of stories where, let's say they're driving on the road and they're stopped, it means they're going to search the entire car that they're in for drugs and other kind of stuff. And I think the general perception, it is good, all right, or at least it's gotten better in my experience, but the general idea is that people with locks are bad people.
So do you think that you're, you know, taking it, as it were, to the education department, and it was quite high profile at the time that you did do it, do you think it helped change perceptions about people with locks?
I think gradually it is, or it has, because, you know, each time I interact with people and then I read comments on the post that we've made, it turns out it is doing a good job, because a lot of people in the Ghanaian communities and across the world are coming to realize that not everyone with locks is intending to do bad things all the time.
The issue that you faced with locks and generally the policing of hairstyles and cuts and so on is a big problem around the world for especially young black men, not just on the continent. So shall we brag a little bit about how somebody with locks did in one of the tough exams in West Africa, the West Africa Senior Secondary School Examination. Come, you're a top performing student. You scored A's in your final exam, and you didn't use a calculator apparently for some of those tough exams. Just tell us.
Yeah. although I got into the school, there were some challenges. I had missed an entire semester because of the court case, and I was a day student with all those challenges.
It must have been difficult, right? Because that's a lot of pressure. You already have the pressure of exams, and now you have the pressure of public scrutiny as well. It couldn't have been easier.
Yeah. From the search that I did, there were like close to 500 students who scored all A's. And the total test takers were like 2.2 million. So that was when I thought, okay, I think it's not that easy as I thought. But yeah, that was the
You thought it was easy to get the top A's for all your subjects, physics, chemistry, maths, elective maths, all of that.
And everything, yeah.
And you weren't worried. You didn't think you might have messed up or anything like that. Were you confident?
Not to brag, but I really enjoyed it without the calculator.
What did it teach you, this fight that you had on your hands with the Department of Education and your success now when going into your life?
I think sometimes challenges come our way to only make us stronger and tougher. Straight up to my background, I remember how the whole court case was going up and down. Sometimes you'd read the comments and it's so heartbreaking. You know, you really work hard to get there. But along the entire stress, which I had to get used to, it meant that I could tolerate a lot of intense situations. And at the same time, handling school pressure, the WASI pressure, the science and math piece pressure. And I feel like my eventual success probably came from the fact that the challenges in the past have done a good job on me.
Tyrone, it was such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you too.
All right then.
A pleasure.
That's Tyrone Margai, Rastafarian and future engineer. Also, author of The Tales from Achimota School. Focus on Africa was put together by Charles Kitonga and Frenny Jawi in Nairobi. Yvette Wagira Maria, Benjamin Woodruff, and Nyasha Michelle did their bit from here in London. Francesca Dunn was our technical producer. Patricia Whitehorn, our senior producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. Thanks for listening.
rising temperatures,
the extreme weather,
melting ice.
They're all interconnected.
How can we solve this?
The Climate Question is the podcast exploring why we find it so hard to save our own planet.
We have many of the tools that we need.
And how we might change that.
If we do smart things right now, we can take care of our descendants.
It is a question of awareness. It is a question of information and access to that information.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service.
It is based on experience and it is based on science.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.